This episode is brought to you by BlackWidowPro.com. Black Widow Pro has power sports carriers, ramps, lift tables, and more to easily move or work on every toy in your garage. From dirt bikes and cruisers up to ATVs and UTVs, listeners can save 15% off their order by using coupon code TIRE. Black Widow Pro, inspired by passion. This is the Motorcycle Show, episode 9 for August 28th, 2021. I'm Crash.
And I'm Daddy No Fun.
And we're joined by a special guest, maybe a recurring guest. We don't know. His name is Tom. How are you, Tom?
I'm doing well. Thank you guys very much for inviting me in.
Yeah, this has been quite a lot of scheduling. We eventually got it to work. Some unexplained technical difficulties that we'll probably never fully understand stopped the last episode we were going to record together. But
We were at the mercy of the internet gods.
We were. And I got to say, I'll just go ahead and say it on air. Thank you for being persistent and patient. our deepest gratitude for your patience and persistence with making sure this happens.
Not a problem.
Let's see. I'm going to venture a guess, since this is a motorcycle show and you're on it, that you ride a motorcycle.
I do. I have been riding. I'm coming up on 14 years now. So got started a little bit later in life. Was not one of those that a lifelong motorcyclist. Sure. But I did own a bike when I was a kid, probably my early teens. I had I don't know if it was a Suzuki, I remember, and it was either a 50 or a 70 cc, something like that. All I remember was that it was a 3-speed but no clutch.
Okay.
So whatever bike that was, yeah, at that time, that was sorry, I'll date myself, early mid 70s.
Okay. And now what do you ride? Now I'm assuming you've graduated to a clutch and a slightly larger displacement.
I graduated to a clutch. I've been on and off clutches for those 14 years, and new bike now does not have a clutch. Oh. And I love it. So recently, about 2 months ago, I stepped up to a Goldwing Tour DCT.
Oh.
Mm, interesting.
Steve, you've been eyeballing those.
Yeah. I've actually
the best statement was that I told the wife that I was buying that, her first statement was, "Oh, you're going for the old man's bike." It's like, well, not quite, but yeah, so I've had that for about 2 months. I've got about 2,000 miles on it right now, and really like the whole no clutch thing.
Nice. Yeah, I've been really enjoying having a quick shifter on my KTM. I can get away without the clutch for a lot of things, and I can understand the allure of not having the clutch.
You really, when I test rode it, it freaked me out. I really had a hard time getting used to the shift points. I mean, I like the bike a lot, and I've test ridden both of them, the 6-speed and the DCT. The shift points were a little early for me, you know, in the automatic settings. And that was like, I don't remember what setting I had it in as far as the power setting. But the bike, man, I tell you what, I loved it. I like the 6-speed more, and maybe because I'm just so used to shifting. And that's part of the appeal for the owning a motorcycle for me too, is that, you know, concert of hands, feet, that whole thing, that it's very visceral for me. I wanted to ask you something, Tom, before we get, you know, talk about what was the event 15 years ago that was the springboard for you back into motorcycling?
To jump on it. I'm going to blame my wife again for it. So I had, we lived on a cul-de-sac and had a neighbor that was selling a, scooter, a Bergman 400. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he had it out on his lawn. Of course, being on a cul-de-sac, we go back and forth all the time. And I kept admiring it and telling the wife, that really looks neat. And then the bike went away for about a month, and we weren't that friendly with that particular neighbor, or didn't talk with him a lot. So it was like, all right. So it went away. And then about a month later, it showed back up. Hmm. So as we were driving home one day, she says, "Why don't you go talk to him about it?" I'm like, okay. So I walked over, I talked to him. I walked back to her. I says, "Okay, I bought it." She says, "I told you to go talk to him, not buy it." So so we started off on a big scooter, a Bergman 400. That was my entry drug. graduated just a few months later to a Bergmann 650 exclusive, had that for just several months, and then made the leap into motorcycles, had a V-Strom 1000, owned that for about a year and a half or so, maybe 2 years, and then jumped into the BMW world. And I went through about almost 11 years, three different bikes of BMWs, an RT, then a 1200 GSA, then the last one was a 1200 2018 GS. So this is new going to the Honda outside of, you know, being so long with the boxer engine and just some of the, you know, you get used to the quirks in a brand,
right?
And BMW certainly has them, and the Honda has them as well. Now, I've also owned other scooters in mixed in with those bikes. Had a Honda Elite 110, which was an interesting bike with my big ass on it. I could get it up to 42 and downhill with a tailwind. But then my last that I had for a few years was a Vespa 300. So really like that. But when I got rid of the GS and got the Honda, I looked at the Vespa and it's like, okay, the Honda kind of, the Goldwing kind of fits the same thing as the Vespa. It's just bigger. It's an automatic. It's got bags. I mean, the Vespa was my grocery getter and used to be my commuter when I actually went to an office.
The Vespa 300 is a really nice scooter.
It was it was a fun around town. That thing was a blast.
Crash, does any of Tom's story, hold on, Tom, does any of Tom's story ring a bell for you?
Yeah, I feel like you guys should be best friends. This is
so. I got to tell you.
this is just like talking to Steve for the very first time.
I had a 15-year hiatus with owning a motorcycle, and my wife decided we were going to buy a bike, right? And she, of course, I knew in her mind she wanted like a leather fringe jacket, you know, riding on the back of a Harley, but I wasn't going to go there. So we started looking at motorcycles. This was end of 2001, popped into a dealership, and they had two 2002, you know, this was November model year V-Stroms sitting in there, DL1000's first year. And eerily enough, they were used in a Suzuki Bergmann 650 rollout as demo bikes for the Suzuki riders. And the guy from the dealership, and I've told this story a million times, the guy from the dealership said, nobody's going to ever buy these. You're the dumbest looking thing I've ever seen in my life. We'll give you $1,000 off. So yeah, it was a DL1000 was the bike that was like my entry back into motorcycling, which is kind of funny because you mentioned having a DL. But it's funny that you did that transition from BMW into Honda. Like, and I would never call the Goldwing, especially the newer year, an old man's bike. A definitely more of a comfortable touring bike. But I mean, it fits in the same vein as like an RT or the KL. But what was the reason though, going from that to Honda? Was it just an opportune time or wanting to try a different bike?
So I've always changed bikes. I've unfortunately, I guess, never owned a bike more than 3 or 4 years. I always get that 3 year itch when I own something.
That's
and
crash.
I always buy a bike based on whatever my riding style is. So my GS was set up strictly as a road bike, and I rode it basically as a big sport bike. But wanted to, maybe, you know, getting older and such, wanted to kind of do some more riding with my wife. We do a few trips now and then, but the GS with the top box on it was comfortable. I did have Russell Daylong seats on it, so I could go all day on it. But it was, and it's a pack mule. You could pack, you know, we never had any trouble bringing whatever we wanted on that thing. But it was a tall bike too. My seat was 35 inches. Now, not a big deal for me. I'm a larger than the average bear, so that worked out well. But it was just, okay, I want something different. I've never owned a bike like the Goldwing before. I was intrigued when the new design came out, and especially the 21. So I did buy a new 2021 because the trunk got bigger. They changed the backrest. It got more comfortable. Just last year, they updated the software, so the DCT worked better. Everything I read about it was glowing. And it was just, I guess, wanting a change. And I've ridden the bike fairly hard with some groups, and I'm getting used to the DCT and how it handles. It handles so much different than the GS. And I think I've got a setting now where I'm not finding the pegs on most curves.
But
you're right. As far as you got it, I like the shifting on it. So I swap between, it's got four modes to it. Rain, Eco, Tour, and Sport. Spend 95% of the time in the Tour mode. And you're right. The shifting is, you're in seventh gear at 40 miles an hour. I mean, it shifts up really quick, but you don't feel it. That's a nice thing.
Yeah, I kind of felt like it was really early, and that was like the first year bike too. So it may be completely different now, you know?
Yeah, I wonder if they modified those shift points or, you know, whatever like that.
Last year, I understand in 2020, they put out a software change that changed the shift points quite a bit and smoothed it out quite a bit. Now, I don't know if there was any, I think that was the main change. I don't know if they did anything to the transmission. All the reviews that I read was that, oh, it was so much better. And I did just last week get to ride a 6-speed. So did that. Very glad I still went with the DCT. Nice. You port it in sport mode and the bike is completely different in sport mode. The throttle response is extremely abrupt. I mean, if you grab a handful of throttle, it is going to fly away from you and you've got to hang on. The amount of torque and get up on it is some people say too abrupt for them. I'm getting used to it. And that's usually when I get up into the mountains, what I set it on, and ride that occasionally. Now I'm just getting used to occasionally putting in manual mode and doing that, but I haven't developed the muscle memory with the using paddle shifters with my fingers yet.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the first time I got in a car that had this sort of like selectable gears. It was an automatic, but you could put it in a little like mode or you could click the shifter up or down. And it's such a weird feeling, like, because your hand wants to do the normal like H pattern shifting, or I'm assuming on the bike you want to do something else. And so you'll probably accidentally shift up instead of down, or accidentally shift down instead of up when you have it in manual mode for a while until you get used to it.
Yeah, running the same road in the mountains, I have found I am actually faster in the automatic mode than I am in the manual mode, because I'm not thinking about it. If I feel like I've got to make a downshift, you can still use the paddle shifters while you're in the automatic mode.
Right.
They still work.
Does it downshift based on your braking? Like, how does the automatic downshifting work? Only on RPM or...
I guess it, you know, because it's two different clutches, it's supposed to sense when you're going. So typically, as I'm coming into a curve, as I come off throttle and start braking into the curve, it'll downshift. Mm. And then I find if I keep a little bit of throttle on as I brake through the curves quite a bit, it'll hold that shift. It won't upshift again in the middle of the curve. And then, you know, throttle out as you come out of it, and it immediately goes up a gear.
Interesting. I guess the only thing it doesn't do is like a box shift, you know, where you go like from 5 to 2 or something like that.
That would be, you'd really have to slow down. You know, if you were on an extreme hairpin, then it would come down. It would come down a couple of gears, but you'd have to drop your RPM quite a bit. The good thing is you can never stall the bike. It's always going to shift down into first gear for you if you go that slow.
Interesting. Yeah. Maybe I have to test ride another one.
Yeah.
You know, a newer one.
And you know, around town, I think the Tour is great. I don't mind it shifting up into seventh gear at 40 miles an hour. You just don't pay attention to it. And the only time I miss the clutch is when I'm coming to a stop, I still grab for that Phantom clutch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was looking for a Phantom sixth gear on the TW, like every time I ride it. Like, where's the next gear?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I will say, as far as the difference in highway from my GS is just night and day. It's so easy to ride on the highway, you know, 80 miles an hour. You've got electric windshield, put it up a little bit. I like still looking over the shield, but it blocks the wind. And because of the weight of the bike, I mean, I've never ridden anything this heavy. It's 250 pounds more than my GS was, but super stable on the highway. Where I always felt my GS was a little, I don't know, it wandered a little bit when you got up to 80, and then you were always,
that's a tall bike,
you were always screaming at, you know, at 80 miles an hour. The sixth gear was terrible on the boxer engines. It really wasn't an overdrive. It was a little bit better than the fifth. So you were at 5,000 RPM at 80 miles an hour.
Yeah, that's one of the things.
Well, that's a lot higher than, yeah.
You and I both have a KTM 1290, and we probably have like almost the exact same gear ratios in the gearbox. And our sixth gear is tall as hell. Like,
yeah,
it's comfortable. Like RPM range at in sixth gear is like 100, like 80 to 100. It's super smooth. But if you're doing 60 or 70 in sixth gear on mine on the GT, it feels like it's like lugging.
Yeah.
That was one thing I never understood with BMW and the Boxers, the difference between the GS and the RT. Now, I could see it in the lower gears. You know, the lower gears on the GS were much lower than the RT. But sixth gear, like I say, was on the GS is hardly any difference. But yet on the RT, it was like a true overdrive.
Oh.
At 80 miles an hour, you really had to use sixth gear. You got to be doing 80 because you're at like 3,500 RPM.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Otherwise, like you say, you're almost lugging it. So six was useless unless you're 80 or above on the RT.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I always felt on the GSA and the GS, I was on both of those bikes combined for about 7 years, that highway was good. I mean, I've done some, I did one 900 mile day, pure highway. So doable, but a little buzziness. And yeah, you're pulling along at that 5,000 RPM on it.
And I mean, I guess that's just the way BMW intended it when they're going to market those bikes and sell them. The Tour is the Tour, the GS is the GS. You know, we're really marketing this more for, you know, the quote unquote off-road scene. But
which is funny because between the two, I think the GSA was a better touring bike than the RT.
Hmm. Why? Why'd you feel that way?
Well, one, you got that massive tank. So you got a 7-point gallon,
oh, yeah, that's
7.9 gallon tank that would, you know, had depending on how you run, 350 to 400 miles on it. And because with the boxes on it, it was such a pack mule. I mean, it had over a 500 pound weight load that you could put on it. I had a 50 liter top case that I put on the back. Plus you got a 45 on one side, 35 on the other, and then you could strap crap on top of those boxes. So
yeah,
my wife and I would do a 5-day trip and it was like, take whatever you want. I mean, we got more than enough room.
Yeah.
That's what kills me about the first year Goldwing when they came out with the new design was how small the storage space was.
Yeah. Like going anywhere, pack a lunch. That's all you got room for.
Yeah. That's like a sandwich box on the side.
Yeah, the sides are 30, and I just did my first overnight this past weekend on it, and I just went by myself, so I packed a small bag, and it's a odd shape. I mean, I just took enough clothes for overnight and get it in there, but it'll be a little bit tighter. Yeah, I mean, we'll have to use the top box. Top box is 61 liters, I think.
Tell you,
we've done a day trip where, you know, we were in full gear. Got to our destination, put our helmets in the top, put her jacket in, we're able to stuff our gear in the sides and go walk away and have lunch and walk the town.
Yeah, without having enough gear for a jacket. That. Yeah.
But that's not carrying any luggage. That's just empty bags storing what you're wearing in the helmets, right?
Yeah. So,
right.
You know, but you still got to take off your pants and your jacket where we're, you know, wearing riding pants and jackets and such.
Yeah. That definitely the appeal of the bike like the GS and like my 1290 with either right now I'm running soft bags on the side of mine. So one's like 45 liters, the other one's 35. And yeah, you can cram a lot of crap in there. They kind of expand up to the top a little bit. So it's easy to pack a lot of things in it. And when I first looked at the Goldwing, I was like, damn, man, the GV bags I had on the V-Strom were like 45 liters on each side and 52 liters on the top. You know, just a massive amount of storage space. But
and it's funny on the Goldwing forums, oh my God, the old timers just bemoaned the storage space.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Oh, they bitch about it so much. And I was like, you know, you just learn to carry less. Do you really need that that much crap along with right. you?
It's, yeah. it's you funny because I remember going to, have you ever been to Two Wheels Only in North Georgia?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's a standard day. They
yeah. Ride. So like I was there one time and I'm watching these guys unpack their Goldwing bags. It might even have been a Harley. And they had multiple pairs of jeans packed. You know, and each one was folded and in like a Ziploc bag. So one side case was just nothing but jeans in this one guy's bag. I'm like, what are you doing, man? Like, pack a pair of pants you can wash in the sink and wear over and over again. Like,
exactly. Yeah. 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 I never bring jeans when I am traveling. Everything synthetic that can be washed in a sink or a tub. And thankfully, I don't have to carry camping gear. I don't camp. Sorry, guys. I don't sleep in the dirt.
I was debating whether or not I was going to camp on my upcoming trip going up and down the coast. And I booked an Airbnb for every single night.
There's a lot to be said about a hot shower and a nice bed. Yeah. I did the camping thing a lot. Yeah.
I spent 20 years of my career traveling 100% and living in hotels. So to me, roughing it is there's no room service or HBO on the TV.
Right. Nice. I listen, there's something about camping I still like, you know, but I don't know if I would do, you know, like another multi-day, multi-thousand mile extended trip camping, because there were times when the end of the day is getting close. I'm like, I just want to go to a hotel. Like, I don't want to go to this campground we're going to, you know, like, I don't want to set my tent up. I don't want to do any of that stuff. I just want to go to a hotel.
Yeah. And you know, as you get older, you realize that access to AC is good and access to porcelain during the night is a necessity.
Yeah.
The other thing, like, I've realized I don't mind camping if I'm like basing out of one place. So if we, you know, if like, let's say there was some like massive motorcycle, like Overland Expo. Show up there, I set up my tent, I spend every night there for a couple of nights, and during the day I'm like out riding or seeing stuff or whatever, but I don't have to set up and tear down my tent every night and then every morning. And that I'm good with. It's the, like, if I'm just going a long distance and I have to stop every night in a different place, I'm like, I don't want to set up my tent and then take it down in the morning and then set it up and take it down. It's like, screw this.
And you know, that's funny because like that really decides how you're going to pack. Like, so if you're somebody like me that's got multiple tents, if I'm taking like the last Overland Expo I went to, I took the Redverse, and that's like a nice base camp. You know, you got this big giant tent with a garage. I got chairs set up, my cooking area. I could go take off and do stuff and come back. And I felt comfortable. But for the day, you know, every night type thing, it's the Big Agnes and it's a little tiny tent. And, you know, your whole way of doing things changes. Everything's outside your tent. You don't have an area to store things inside. At middle of the night, before you go to bed, you pull stuff in and kind of make room for it. Because we all know that a two-person tent's really a one-person tent. So, and you're trying to fit gear in there too. Yeah, it's kind of a pain in the ass. I definitely like that base camp idea more if I'm going to be camping, but
One of my annual trips is I ride with a group of BMW guys, and every year we do a long weekend at I don't know if either of you know the Iron Horse Motorcycle Lodge.
Yeah, I've been there.
I've heard of it. Carolina. I've never been.
Stakoa.
And it's a mix of cabins and very nice cabins and tent camping and RV sites as well. And you're based there. So normally it's a 4 or 5 day weekend. So that fits in with, you know, a lot of the guys do camp up there, but you know, I look at it, the appeal is okay. Yes. You're bringing all your stuff and you're sleeping out, whatever, but then the practicality of it loses it when, all right, that storm runs through during the night and soaks everything. Or that Sunday morning when we're all packing up to leave and it's raining out, and I watch them spend, you know, an hour trying to wrap up all their crap and get it on the bike, and it's piled high with their tent gear and all their other stuff to make themselves comfortable. And I just grab my clothing bags and put them on the bike and go home.
It's definitely a learned skill when it's raining, because there's a system, you know, how you pack stuff up and how you, and it's like you said, it's kind of a pain in the ass. And usually you pack stuff wet and you just want to get out of there. That's when, like you said, the appeal of being in your cabin or in your hotel room and like, ah, yeah, I'll have another cup of coffee, wait for this to stop. And
yep.
Just kind of, you know,
like, yeah, like last weekend I went up. So every time I get a new bike, my thing is I get to go up to the Dragon and just run it on the Dragon. So that's just a thing I do. I like sharp technical roads, so that kind of fits in. So I went up last weekend, got up Saturday morning. It was like 7% chance of rain up in Robbinsville, which is just south of Deals Gap where the Dragon is. It's like, great, it's going to be dry, everything looked great for the day. Rode with a group in the morning, went up there, got up to Robbinsville about 2 o'clock, pouring rain. All right, rode the Dragon, completely wet, at least didn't get rained on at that. And then it was that night, okay, I stayed in a hotel. And that was great because I could throw a half cover on the bike and that kept it all nice and dry. And, you know, check weather for Sunday morning, 0% chance of rain Saturday night. Well, this is life in the mountains. Sunday morning, absolute downpour. So I was going to ride the Chirihala, and I've been on the Chirihala in the pouring rain, and there was another front coming through, and I was like, the hell with it, packed up and went home. I mean, luckily, I'm in North Atlanta, so I'm 2.5 hours from Tail of the Dragon, so it's an easy, quick ride home.
Nice.
It's a nice area where you are, too, because you have access to so many things. Where South Florida, it's like 5 hours to get out of Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm in suburbs north of Atlanta, Marietta, and my standard ride is usually about 5 hours. I'll run up into the mountains there. One of the most famous rides around here is Blood Mountain. So take that up in Wolfpen Gap, which brings you right into Two Wheels of Sutches.
Yeah, that's Wolfpen Gap's a great road. Yeah.
Yeah. And Two Wheels is a standard lunch stop, and it's kind of like Crash. It's kind of like, I guess, the rock store.
Oh yeah, yeah.
The east, you know, in the southeast here, where any given Saturday or Sunday, there could be 100 bikes there.
Right. Yeah.
It's just a stopping point for everybody.
You guys talking about riding in rain, it just occurred to me. I was like, I don't remember the last time I got wet on a motorcycle.
You've had a dry spell anyway out there, right?
I mean,
besides that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a frequent thing in San Diego like it is in South Florida, but
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I used to commute to work guaranteed in the pouring rain every day I was going to work. So there was only a couple times when it was really hairy. I can think of two or three times that I'm not exaggerating, terrified. One of them was on I-10 going through Texas. And it was probably one of the worst thunderstorms I've ever ridden in. And tractor trailers are just blowing by me. So a couple times I actually pulled into where the like the toll plazas were and just kind of tried to wait it out. But it wasn't letting up. And then a few times riding south on the Florida Turnpike where I couldn't see the car in front of me. It was so bad. And people are like honking their horns. I'm trying to go slow and I'm looking, I got my head like on the outside of the windscreen trying to see. And the same thing, I just found a safe place to pull off and wait it out. I think at one time I was actually almost late to work because it was so bad. I called in and said, man, I'm kind of stuck on the road here. It's raining so bad.
Yeah.
But
not having windshield wipers is not fun.
Yeah. Other than that, it usually, like if it's a little bit of a Florida rain shower, I don't mind it, especially wearing, you know, either I used to wear Aerostitch gear and now it's Climb. And I like the fact that I already have my rain gear on. I don't have to stop and put something covering my jacket. It's already ready to go. I just maybe close a couple vents. But
so, Steve, we're similar in that too. I do a mix of Aerostitch and Climb gear.
Yeah.
But in the summertime, weird. I wear just a mesh jacket, and you know, it's 85, 90 degrees. I welcome the rain. It's like, go ahead, get me wet.
Yeah.
Especially riding in mountains, you know, you're going to go over the next ridge, and it's probably going to be dry on the other side of the mountain.
Yeah, and especially if you're not wearing a cotton shirt, you're wearing something that dries really quick, like a performance wear shirt. And I'm the same way. As soon as you get back into any sunshine, you're like you're cooling off and you're dry, and it's nice.
So, Steve, you recently had some KTM related stuff happen.
Yeah. So after the last show we recorded, the next day I went to go ride to go to, we have a place in South Florida, Tom. So
your brakes were seized up, right? That was the issue, right?
Yeah. The brakes seized. Thank God it happened at a light where I wasn't riding. It just, when I left, the oddest thing, when I left the warehouse, pumped up the rear brake, like the rear brake was very spongy. I hit it a couple times and it was up to pressure. The front brake just started to get a little tighter, I noticed. By the time I got to the traffic light, I couldn't move the bike at all.
Right.
It's almost like it vapor locked, like on a mountain bike sometimes, you know, with disc brakes. I couldn't move it for anything. I tried pushing it. It was completely locked up. And then the bike wouldn't start. It was giving me an error saying front brake switch.
Right.
So the record driver came, you know, he was like, he had a flatbed. He's like, I don't really have any way of getting this bike up on here. And so I thought real quick, I put it up on the center stand and lifted the front wheel off the ground. I said, hey, do me a favor, see if you can spin the front wheel. Well, he did, and it unlocked it. So I'm like, all right, I'm just going to ride it back to the warehouse, you know, like, and I said, is there a charge? He's like, no, it's closed. Don't worry about it. Well, it wouldn't start at all. It kept giving me that front brake switch error. So, you know, he lowered the flatbed. He said, I'll push it up. You raise the back of the flatbed, and we strapped it down and he brought it over to the warehouse. So, and I've yet to take it apart and try to figure out what it is. So I tried to drain some of the brake fluid out of it, and there's not a single wrench in the kit that fits that 12-millimeter hub on the top where the handlebars are. And I think you told me the one down by the by the brake pads, 8.
Yeah, mine has a bleeder up there too, like an actual, like a, I think mine has like an 8-millimeter like bleeder up on top of my, like my brake master cylinder, but.
So that bleeder at the top is 12 millimeters. Oh. And then somebody told me that the one down by the actual brakes themselves is 8, I couldn't find it. I didn't look hard enough. And then I was actually trying to like fashion a duct tape, you know, trough so that when I opened the bleeder at the top, it would like flow down to the ground, not all over my handlebars and everything.
Yeah.
But there's like a multi wrench tool in there that's designed for one of the larger nuts that's got a 12 millimeter hole on it, but it was, you know, not. You couldn't turn it. You put it on there and it would like skip, you know, it wasn't exactly like 12 millimeters, there, right? So I might go by there tomorrow and pull it apart and see what the hell's going on. You know, other than that, I'll have to tow it over to the dealership. But yeah, that was weird. The first time I've ever had anything happen like that on a bike.
So you got it safely back, but still not sure.
No, and I haven't. No, the week's been kind of busy between work and everything else. So I haven't had a chance to go over there. Plus, with not having air conditioning in my warehouse, it's blazing hot during the day. So I may wait to go over there on an evening. I got two big like shop fans I'll have on there. And it was funny because right before I took the bike out for a ride, I started taking all the decals off of it that I had from the trip. And I still think I might sell the bike and get something different.
Yeah.
So I'm going to probably pull off the soft bag mounts and put the hard bags back on it. And maybe sell the soft bags separately or keep them. I don't know. You know, they're universal. It's just the mounts are different, but we'll see. I don't know. I've been waffling back and forth. I was looking at bikes this morning. You know, I was looking at, you're going to laugh. I was looking at a Sportster S.
You're right.
And then I started
to laugh at that one too. Sorry.
You know, it's just the way
it's just unexpected.
Looks.
Like totally out of left field. Like he's been talking about like getting a BMW GS or maybe a Honda Goldwing. So I was looking at a Sportster S today. I'm like, what?
I'm looking all over the place, man. I've been on small displacement bikes looking at those, but then I started looking at the difference between a Sportster S and an Indian FTR because I know like Wes and a couple people have made that comparison.
Yeah.
And the new FTR to me looks absolutely butt ugly. Like I do not like the way it looks.
I test rode one of those. It's nice, but it get buzzy as hell. I mean, it's more of a, it'd be a nice toy.
Yeah. Cause you do like a five, you just said your standard ride is a 5-hour ride. Like that's a long time dealing with some vibration.
I hadn't heard that negative review about it being buzzy. I just thought the thing, you know, I don't know. I've never heard Wes talk about his being buzzy.
Now this was the new one that I test rode. It was just a few months ago. So it was with a new 17-inch front, but maybe it was just me, but I found it was a very aggressive riding position for what it was. I mean, your legs are tucked up under you. Like I say, I'm taller, so disclosure, I'm 6'3", 34 inch inseam. So it's a little bit of a tight fit on the bike, but
you feel cramped on it, right?
Yeah. And I thought upper RPMs, it was definitely a lot of vibration in the handlebars.
That's interesting. And maybe the Harley's got definitely fatter wheels. The geometry is a little bit different. It's a little bit stretched out more. I don't know. You know, again, it's like I'm fickle right now, just looking at a bunch of different bikes. And then goofing around, I saw Honda came out with an 1100 Rebel now. Did you see that, Chris?
I don't know. Oh, yeah. I had heard about it. Mm-hmm. It's the African motor. Hey,
you get that with the DCT.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Now, those are all feet forward, though. I don't think any of those have mid controls.
No, they're all mid controls. The Rebel's a mid control bike, yeah. And the now the Sportster S, I don't think it is. That's feet forward, and that's that would definitely eliminate that bike for me because I can't ride that position at all. I just like the way it looked. I thought it was kind of cool looking.
It does look pretty nice. I'll give them that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still kicking around the idea of a mid to small displacement bike or...
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. There's so much stuff out there I like.
Yeah. It looks like here in the near future, I might be in the market for a new motorcycle because I might have no motorcycles. I haven't decided yet. Last episode, we talked about how I got orders to Japan and I was kind of waffling back and forth about what bike to take or whether I was going to take a motorcycle with me. And I got an email the other day that's basically like from it's from some part of the Navy that basically like helps you figure out your move stuff. And it was like a quick list of things to know if you're going to try to bring certain things to Japan. So like if you have pets and you're going to bring your pets to Japan, there's like a quarantine period they have to go through once they get there and blah, 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 stuff like that. For motorcycles, they said if it's over 250 cc's, so the TW is fine. But if it's over 250 cc's, then it has to be tested for its braking capability and it has to have an emissions test. And the only places, there are very few locations to get that test done. Fortunately, there is one in Tokyo and I'm not so far from Tokyo that I wouldn't be able to do that. But they said it's around $800 to get it tested. And then if your bike doesn't meet their criteria for whatever reason, then you're either having to pay on your own dime to get it up to standards or you can't register it. And you're just stuck with a bike that you can't ride in Japan or, ship it back home at your own expense or whatever. But the KTM, I've been told that Japan's emissions requirements are less strict than California's. So I think I will probably be okay emissions wise. And there's no reason that they wouldn't pass their braking standards. The Super Duke GT is sold in Japan. So even if it's, for some reason, there's like, oh, yeah, there's this one special part that makes it Japan legal. Like, I could get it, but I don't know that I want to.
They won't accept the California emissions test?
Mm-mm. No, you have to take it and get it tested at a facility there. So,
interesting.
Yeah.
That's the only thing holding you back, is that?
Yeah, it's like, it'd be $800 to get it, or ish. I don't know the actual price. Those are like the estimates from the Navy. But yeah, it says like around $800 to get the test done.
That's insane. Like, for a... emissions test and the braking test.
Yeah. And I'd have to go to Tokyo to get it done, which is like an hour and a half or so away. Again, not the worst, but I was thinking about how the KTM is not special. Anybody could go buy another one just like it right now. It's not unique or anything. So
what about? Yeah, I was going to say, have you really customize these and married to the bike or just...
No, not at all, Tom. Well, that's exactly my point.
If you're just going to be there for a couple of years,
that's what I'm thinking.
Unload and get something there.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Doug from Amen Moto made the suggestion that I should sell both of them. And this is before I even knew about this. He's like, you should just sell both of them and then buy something cool and Japanese and bring that home. that you can't get in the States.
That would be a really,
I think that's a good idea.
Option. Yeah. Because you see a lot of those in South Florida, stuff that people had bought like in Malaysia. I told you before, there's like GP bikes running around here that don't have light. Cause Florida is really easy. depending on where you go, what tag agency, a lot of them out in the sticks, they don't even care. They don't even go out and look at the bike.
Like, that thing got wheels on it? Here's a license plate.
They don't care. They're not looking at it. They're not looking for anything. A couple guys I know brought bikes back from, there's a company out of Malaysia that sells like old 250 GP bikes, you know, like RS250s. And the guy was like, yeah, I bought this when I was in the military and I have a lot of sentimental value. And they're like, no problem. Here's a plate and a registration for it. So, that's probably a good idea.
I was tempted by Doug's suggestion, and then I saw like the I'm gonna have to pay extra money on top of the registration and all that sort of stuff. Like, and the thing is, when you as an American buying a vehicle over there, I don't know how to read Japanese, so like I'm gonna have to have another person help me through every step of this process. And I was like, that's just more steps. I don't know. I don't want to do that.
You mean to tell me?
Yeah, I like the idea of just buying something unique to Japan.
Yeah.
That you can't get in the States.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There's probably people there that do that will help you.
Oh, I know there's people that'll help you, and like at the car dealerships and stuff, or you know that they, you know, it's just like buying a car here. Like they help you process all the paperwork and that sort of thing. But like having to jump through the extra like regulatory hoops with a vehicle I already own, I would have to like bring somebody with me to every, you know, like bring a translator with me everywhere.
Just turn your phone on and make it talk into like the Google Translate.
It does okay. Thing. Yeah, I've done that. Yeah. It's not the worst, but.
Listen, I saw a truck that I actually texted Phil the other day about it. There's a truck that they're going to be releasing in Australia only. That's the 70th anniversary of the.
Yes, I saw this.
The Series 70. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
Toyota Land Cruiser Series 70, they're releasing an SUV version and a truck version only in Australia. And it has like built in all of the super cool upgrades like that you would want.
Eight cylinder diesel. Vehicle. Yeah. Locking rear and front differentials. Snorkel.
Everything.
And it's like, I think they said the price was like $54,000, you know, like way less than I paid for my stupid Explorer.
And the body style is like really, it's like got kind of a sort of a retro look to the body too.
Right. So it was funny because right when I saw that article, I was driving back from the airport and I took a picture. I saw a Series 70 truck in South Florida on the highway with the snorkel, like the two-door one. And I texted Phil. I'm like, what the hell is that? And he said that's also a Series 70. So
Yeah,
I don't know. I'm agreeing with Tom. I think you should at least get rid of the bikes and see what you can find.
I've got like three friends that were saying like, hey, before you move to Japan, if you want to get rid of that TW, let me know. So I'm sure you'd
have no problem selling that at all.
None at all. The biggest problem I've had is getting the title, which it's on its way finally. I've had the bike for almost 2 months now, and the title is finally going to be here. For some reason, this was a guy that had bought it before, had bought it new, financed it, and you know, through Yamaha Financial, and they took forever to tell the DMV to release the title, and then now they finally did, and it's finally coming. So I'll basically get it registered to me, because he filled everything out on the title already, including like my name and the sales date and everything. Like he was very meticulous. And I was like, I was kind of hoping you would just leave that blank so I could just never register it to myself and sell it to the next guy.
Yeah, that would have made life a lot easier.
Yeah, so I'm going to finish registering it in my name and then like turn around and sell it to Jay LaRosa from Losa Engineering probably.
You know, this is not a bad time to be selling bikes. They are, depending on the market and the bike, they can be at a premium.
Yeah.
I mean, I got good numbers when I traded in my GS, and I sold my Vespa I had it for a little over 3 years and less than $1,000 for what I paid new for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a little bit, there's some like cosmetic ugliness about the GT that I feel like would, you know, probably drive the price down a little bit, but I'm not trying to make money on the thing. I'm just going to try to unload it and move on. But I also have a trip to do, so I'm not going to sell it soon. I'm just going to take my trip and then sell my house and then start selling off all my other stuff probably over the winter. And I know the winter's not a good time to sell bikes usually, but thankfully it's Southern California. We don't really have one of those.
You know, the only other thing I was thinking of when it comes to buying the bike in Japan, what's the licensing situation? Like if you come over there driving on you're driving on a California driver's license, or do you have to get a Japanese one? You have to take a motorcycle test. How does that work?
I'm not 100% certain how all of that works. I know that, in fact, it's actually mentioned in that email they sent me, but there's a, there's that like AAA international driver's license thing that you can just like, it's like, have either of you guys ever heard of it?
No, you've mentioned it before, but okay, I don't know what it is.
Basically, AAA does this thing where you fill out a form or whatever, and they just send you a driver's license that, I guess in like just a couple of languages, it says like this person is licensed to operate a motor vehicle, basically. It has some other information on that. And it's supposed to go kind of like hand in hand with your, or, you know, US state driver's license. And it just sort of helps like translate everything. And so there's a agreement between the United States and Japan that like I can drive on my American driver's license out there. I think I just have to take like, on the base, I think I have to take a little test or something. I don't remember exactly. I had to take a test. I have a on-base driver's license for the base that I'll be staying on, or that I'll be working on. I already have a license for them to be able to drive their like rental cars around the base. But I don't think I actually have to do anything super special. Yeah.
Is that because you're going to be there for an extended period? Because I've done, you know, several vacations into Europe and driven all over Europe,
right.
And never, you know, never bothered with any license.
Right. Thing. Exactly. Yeah. It's because I'm in the military and I'll be living there and they're making, and then they have a agreement sort of thing with, so if I were just visiting, I would be perfectly legal to just drive and it would be fine. But, and I think that in terms of the Japanese government's perspective, they still are going to treat that the same way. Like I'm able to, you know, buy a car and drive it and whatever. But the base has like policies because, you know, they drive on the left side of the road and there's a whole bunch of extra sort of like symbols and stuff that you'll see on people's cars. Like there's a little window dangly thing or like a sticker on the back of somebody's trunk that says if they're a new driver. And basically if they're a new driver, they're not at fault for hardly anything. Because you're supposed to give them extra space and extra time and extra care because they don't know how to drive yet. And then there's also one for if you're over 75, there's this like little clover leafy kind of thing that you stick on your car that basically goes to the same thing. Like if they're over 75, you're supposed to give them extra care and extra time and extra, you know, and like because they're older and, you know, reaction times are slower and all that sort of stuff. So if you get into an accident with them, it's probably your fault, you know, stuff like that.
The hardest part is always the driving on the left side. I had driven throughout Europe and loved driving in Italy and Spain. I found England the hardest to drive, even though the road signs were in English, just because that, especially roundabouts and just being on that left side, messed me up more than anything in Italy or Spain, not knowing the, you know, couldn't read the signs.
Yeah. Driving around on base the last time I was out there, we pulled into the right lane so many times. Like we would go to like take a turn and be like, oh shit, wrong side of the road. Like
I used to hit curbs a lot.
I imagine I would probably do the exact same thing. Like I would be so confused half the time about where I was supposed to go.
Yeah. My main goal actually, I know that I will end up buying a car when I'm out there, but my main goal in commuting and everything is to use a vehicle as little as possible while I'm out there. Because the trains are so good, the buses are so good, everything is so clean. Like you know, the trains, like you're not sitting on like some nasty ass subway with like, you know, 45 people making huge amounts of noise, like all jammed in there. I mean, they will really get jammed in there on the trains, but everybody's like quiet and polite. And I also found out you can't take your bicycle on the train unless you have a little bag for it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is, I guess, explains why there's so many folding bikes out there, because the bag size is like there's a maximum dimension for the bag. I don't remember what it is, but basically, if you don't have a folding bike, you have to pull the front wheel off in order to get your bike into a bag that's within that size requirement. And I think the bag is to keep your nasty, wet, gross bicycle from touching other people's stuff or from getting the train dirty. And it's also because I'm sure if either of you have ever tried to move a bicycle from one place to another while you're not riding it, everything on the bike catches on everything around it early, like the pedals are like, ooh, let me grab that wire. And the handlebars are like, ooh, let me hook on that branch. And so that you don't yank everybody's backpack and purse off while you're trying to move your bike around on the train, they have you have it in a bag.
So let me ask you this, Chris, have you watched any of these videos on YouTube about how to act in Japan, like the culture and stuff? Like they don't walk and eat and stuff like
that.
Oh
yeah, they don't. No, not at all. They also, one of the things that's interesting is like, it's really common to just take a nap anywhere. Like it's acceptable in their culture to just sleep anywhere. and I don't remember, there's a special word for them, but basically if you're like a middle-class like businessman and you went out with your boss last night and you got trashed, and you just fell asleep on the side of the road or a train station or whatever, and then you just got up and went to work. And when you're done, like that, there's like a special name for doing that. And it's apparently acceptable to fall asleep even at your desk, like to just sit up and kind of like nod off for a little bit, because it's like, oh, he's working super hard. He's working so hard, he fell asleep. And it's like, apparently people will fake sleep to be, look
get out
like
of work.
Look like they're doing a really hard job, like to look like they've worked themselves to the point where they're falling asleep.
I wouldn't need to fake that at all. I've got a George Costanza desk in my office with like a little alarm clock and bed underneath it. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I've worked in some government offices where I've come upon or had people sleeping at their desk, but it wasn't because they were working so hard.
No, I've never, I've been asleep at my desk and it was not because I was working hard either.
Yeah, I've got this built-in alarm clock. So no matter what I do, I only get about 5 hours of sleep. So by like 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I can't keep my eyes open. I'm like dead. It's so hard.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm like really excited about, like, I feel like I'm going to live vicariously through you when you're over there, and I'm definitely planning a trip to come see you. But I was just curious, why buy a car if you're going to buy a bike, and you said you want to commute as little as possible, why buy the car?
Hold on. One of you guys' internet connection just started doing something really weird. Steve, can you mute yourself?
Yeah, hold on.
Oh wait, it just stopped. That was. Is it?
Didn't know if it was me.
I don't know either.
Yeah, consider just being a bike. So I do that. I don't own a personal car. My motorcycle is my primary transportation.
It rains a lot, and I'll really only be there in the winter. Like I'll be there in the fall, winter, and spring in Japan. And so I'm gonna try as long as I can to not buy a car. But I am sort of in the back of my mind accepting the fact that I will probably buy a car at some point while I'm there.
Get yourself an Aerostitch onesie, R3.
Oh yeah. I've been wanting one of those.
Great for in the rain. That was my commuter suit. I still have it, and it's hot in the summer. You know, I can't wear it over 80 degrees, but if you are going point to point and you want to be dressed when you get there and dry, it's a great suit to have.
I've kind of always wanted one. Before I leave, maybe I'll take the time to go through like getting one that fits right and, you know, potentially sending it back for alterations or whatever I need to, and then get it all good and then take it with me to Japan.
Yeah, I've got the light version, and I did it a few years ago at one of their pop-ups, so it's custom made to me. And it's funny, you get that suit, and when you're standing in it, oh my God, it looks like crap. It, you know, the right. Legs are long, the arms are long, the seat's long. But you sit on the bike, and it's like it fits perfectly.
Right.
Because it's made for you sitting in that position. They're nice. It's just... it gets hot, so I don't wear it.
Yeah, and I won't have to deal with I won't have to deal with a ton of hot weather out there, because I'll be missing basically every summer.
Is that when your leave is? Summertime?
So the ship that I'll be attached to, so the squadron that I'm going to always deploys on the same ship, and the schedule, they're out underway from like May to November almost every year.
Okay,
like there's a little bit of variation in there, but they're basically deployed every summer. It's the USS Ronald Reagan. They're underway right now. That's where I was when I was in June, whatever it was, when I went out on the ship that for a few weeks. That's the ship I was on. Like I said, they have a pretty consistent cycle of when they deploy. So,
what's the possibility of you bringing me on a Tiger cruise, just like your older brother or something?
I mean, if they do them, sure. I'd be down. We could probably make that happen. I think we got to wrap it up. I think most of us have some commitments. I can't think of any other fun motorcycle nonsense to talk about anyway at the moment. So
I got a whole bunch of stuff, but we'll save it for next time.
Nice. Well, Tom, thanks for being on the show. It's been fun.
Hey, it was fun get you on shooting again the crap soon. With you guys. And yeah, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it sounds like you and Steve are like soulmates or something.
Yeah, well, we're probably close to the same age, so.
Yeah.
I lived in Florida for a long time, so I know what it's like down there.
Yeah.
All right. Yes. Well, get out and ride.
See ya.
All right. Thanks.